The longtime conventional wisdom surrounding pedophilia has been that childhood experiences create an unnatural sexual attraction to kids. However, recent research points to a more common cause, an inborn orientation, perhaps created in utero. With us is Dr. Fred Berlin, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Director of the Sexual Behavior Consultation Unit at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Dr. Berlin, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
What leads researchers to suspect fetal development relates to a sex drive toward children?
Well, there's been a variety of sorts of research. Some of it has to do with the number of people with pedophilia who are, for example, left-handed, something that we know is pretty much hardwired. But if I may, I don't think the important issue is whether this is, or the degree to which pedophilia is due to nature versus nurture. Further research will clarify that. What I think people need to understand is that it's not due to voluntary choice. That none of us as little kids think about who we want to be attracted to when we grow up. We discover who we're attracted to, and people who are attracted to children discover that in growing up. They haven't simply chosen to experience an alternative state of mind.
But if pedophilia is largely created through being sexually abused as a child, wouldn't the treatment implications be very different than if it has to do with fetal development and is not related to post-birth experiences?
Not necessarily, because even if pedophilia is to some extent learned, it doesn't mean it can be unlearned. There are some things that are learned that, in a sense, get stamped in and can't be unlearned. I don't know the extent to which my attraction to women is due to biological factors or perhaps even certain sorts of early life experiences. But once I have that attraction, I don't think anybody can teach me to lose it. So I don't know. We do want to understand more about the cause, but knowing the cause doesn't necessarily direct the treatment that's going to be available.
Don't you think there's significant societal implications to it, though? Certainly when it comes to human sexuality and the idea that homosexuality is inborn has had a big effect on the social implications of that.
Well, I absolutely think that society needs to understand that people don't choose what their sexual makeup is going to be all about, and that good people, through no decision of their own, may have very different kind of sexual makeup than most of us. Now, in our technological society, where we put a lot of weight onto being able to show a picture, certainly if we could say, here's the abnormality in brain, or here's the genetics that are at fault, that would probably move us forward. I personally find it a shame that just understanding that it isn't a person's fault, that they need help, that alone isn't enough to persuade some folks that we ought to be thinking along those lines.
So how could society or informal treatment, pedophiles who are essentially hardwired, be helped to resist their drive and not to act out and harm kids?
Well, I think there are a variety of ways, but the first point is that society has to see these as human beings deserving of help. I think these days we use the word pedophilia as such a demonizing pejorative that folks think these are all monsters, and why should we even try to help them in the first place? So initially there has to be a climate of opinion that supports the idea that this is important to do. That said, there are effective treatments available, and I won't go through all of them, but one, for example, has to do with medication. We don't know yet enough about the biology of pedophilia to change an orientation, but if someone, if I can put it in simple terms, is hungering sexy for children, we're very capable medically of lowering the intensity of that hunger, and if they're trying to resist acting, it's much, much easier for them to do so, and the research shows that when that form of treatment is made available to individuals, the recidivism rate tends to be extremely low.
Well, I mean, how do you deal with, what is the essential tragedy in this, that if someone's sexual desire is fixed toward kids and they can't act on that because of obvious harm that does to individuals and society, that their life then consists of either finding ways of lowering sex drive or being permanently unsatisfied?
Yeah, that is one of the tragedies in all of this. And obviously our first concern, every one of us, is the protection of children. But there's a difference between just asking how can we be safe versus asking how, in the context of being safe, can we be fair and just and treat people in a medically appropriate fashion. So there needs to be a sense that these are people, human beings, who through no fault of their own are having difficulties. And then we have to reach out to them. And unfortunately, we do very little of that. It's not a person's fault they have pedophilia. It is their responsibility to do something about it. But we have a society that thinks we can somehow punish it away or legislate it away. And if the only thing we do with these folks is send them to prison, there's nothing in that prison alone that either erases their attractions or enhances their ability to resist acting on them. And sooner or later, like it or not, most of them are back out in the community. So we have to stop giving lip service to the idea that there's a public health as well as a criminal justice aspect to this, and in my judgment, begin to act accordingly.
We're speaking with Dr. Fred Berlin, psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, where he directs the Sexual Behavior Consultation Unit. I'd love to hear from you as an AirTalk listener, particularly if you're someone who has that sexual drive towards kids and you have been able to successfully manage it. How have you done so? What are the ways that you have been able, if you feel like this has been your orientation lifelong, how have you avoided acting out and engaging sexually with a child and damaging that child? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also joining us is Dr. Hai Malinek, clinical and forensic psychologist who practices in Beverly Hills, and he also provides expert court testimony. He consults with the U.S. Attorney's Office in cases of sexual molestation and risk assessment. Thank you, Dr. Malinek, for being with us.
Good morning.
So how does, if at all, the California criminal justice system deal with what is something, you know, more than just a crime, but has to do with fundamentally who someone is sexually?
Well, the research of Dr. Cantor and others about the brains of pedophiles and about the genetic roots of pedophilia is amazing and interesting. At this point, the California courts do not use this research in forensic decision-making. For example, in deciding who could be safe on probation or who should be civilly committed because of repeat sexual offenses. For this kind of research to become relevant, we need to have a much higher level of confidence in it and specificity. There needs to be evidence that there is a specific link between the genetic root, whatever we believe is the cause of pedophilia, and repeat hands-on sexual offenses. Furthermore, the courts here and elsewhere require that certain scientific findings or theories, measures, have to pass a certain level of certainty. It's referred to as the Fry and Daubert test, where we, A, believe that they are used, commonly accepted by the larger professional community, and also that they are valid and reliable, that we could use them as tools before they are admitted as evidence or could serve as the basis for decision-making.
The Los Angeles Times, in a front-page story on this today, cited a 2005 public service campaign in Germany where billboards went up essentially saying that if you have this desire, you don't feel guilty about it, feeling it is different than acting on it, and having a mental health services clinic where people could go to get help for that that kind of proclivity. And the article was saying that would be very difficult to do here because of mandatory reporting. So if anyone came in and indicated they had any kind of contact with a child, they'd be obligated to turn that person over to law enforcement. I'm curious your thoughts about it. I mean, is there a way that there could be some sort of a reach out to those who have these feelings, but gives them freedom in some way to get help?
Well, I certainly hope that this would happen. I think what you just described is the Dunkerfield project that was recently presented in a conference in Denver and has had quite a bit of success in Germany. I think one of the main reasons for it is the lack of stigmatization there. The individuals are assured confidentiality and are essentially able to come in and discuss their thoughts and wishes and learn how to manage attraction to children. In our state and elsewhere, as you know, mandatory reporting laws make it impossible. If you're even if you're a candidate for a civil commitment here in this state, you are required to sign a treatment contract and disclose additional victims if you had any. It certainly impinges quite seriously on the motivation of sexual offenders to open up, to discuss their issues, to make themselves available to treatment. It poses certainly significant difficulties for any treatment efforts. here and in other states.
Dr. Berlin, I'm curious your thoughts about this because, of course, mandatory reporting is designed to first and foremost protect victims or potential victims. We can all see the value in that. Is there some way, though, even with that standing, to get more people into treatment?
Well, I do think we have to have a dialogue about that, and it's extremely difficult because of the understandable emotion that's tied to this issue. I don't think anyone can disagree with mandatory reporting when we've seen a child, he or she has been abused. We need to make sure we put a stop to it, identify other victims. The problem with having mandatory reporting that has no flexibility is that inadvertently we're deterring some undetected people from coming forward and getting the very help that might make the community safer. And I get calls now from people who are interested in coming for help, but they have lawyers advising them to be careful not to self-incriminate, and often they won't put themselves at risk of going to prison in order to get assistance. There's no easy answer to that, but I think we at least have to begin having a dialogue because we're not helping children by driving this problem further underground. The ideal would be to have people come forward before they act so we can prevent victimization from occurring in the first place.
There's been a tremendous crackdown in child pornography, which the internet has made very easy to transmit. And the idea behind that seems to be twofold, one of which is that it's ongoing victimization of the children depicted in those images, unfair to them. Secondly, that it might be a precursor in some way to acting against a child if someone is viewing that material. Dr. Berlin, your thoughts on that and how we deal with child pornography?
Well, certainly we have to protect children and the production of child pornography. We have to make every effort to stop. Now, having said that, to assume that everybody who has an interest in viewing these images is necessarily a risk to children is simply an assumption. We need to do more research. There's some studies now, particularly out of one of the Scandinavian countries, suggesting that many people who have an interest in viewing those images aren't necessarily interested in actually consummating that kind of activity with a youngster. So we need this kind of information. We need education, and we have to not simply make assumptions that may not be based in fact.
Randall in Santa Ana, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, my question is for either of your guests. I'm curious as to whether this type of behavior, is it something that the research shows is they exhibit early in their lives, or is it something that sort of intensifies as they go forward? And I will take my answer up here. Thank you very much.
Dr. Berlin?
Yeah, I think it's like any of us. You know, at some age, we kind of become consciously aware of our attractions, and that's usually the point before we act on them. It may even be before we get into older adolescence. And then as we are older adolescents and testosterone kicks in, the hormones kick in, the drive becomes even stronger. And then eventually most of us act on those attractions, fortunately in a way that doesn't cause harm to others. So it is simply very similar to a different orientation. The problem is, for obvious reasons, as you pointed out earlier, we have to help people not act on those attractions, and that's a very different situation from what the majority of us in society are experiencing.
There are some cases where someone can later in life develop an attraction to kids, right, as a result of a brain abnormality.
Absolutely. We see problems with patients who have Alzheimer's disease. Either they can become generally disinhibited sexually, or they may develop a specific kind of sexual attraction that has been different than what they had before. We've seen it with traumatic brain injury. It's not talked about very often, but it can be a sequelae of that kind of injury. Again, something we sweep under the carpet and need to look at more carefully. So I think if we can just realize, as I said earlier, there's a medical and a public health side to this and begin to support the research and have a dialogue that takes that into account, I think it's going to do some good for all of us as citizens in the society.
Jay in the San Gabriel Valley posts on the Air Talk page, not all that long ago, being LGBT was illegal. Now we generally accept sexual orientation as genetic or innate to an individual's sensibilities. If this theory indeed gains more weight in the scientific and judicial fields, how could this affect our laws? Dr. Malinick, your thoughts?
Well, we have to draw a significant distinction between legal decision-making and diagnosis. Recall also that sexual offenses against children could be brought about by a variety of contexts and reasons. Not all pedophiles molest children, nor are all child molester pedophiles. Sexual offenses against children are multifactorial. It could be brought about by all kinds of reasons and trajectories. And so There's also the impact of age. We know by multiple studies that as individuals age, they are much less likely to commit a sexual offense against a child. And that is true even for exclusive pedophiles who have committed multiple sexual offenses against children. They burn out, and the vast majority stop reoffending after the age of 60. How we deal with them in the legal realm often depends on the specific nature of the laws, the policies, the sentencing guidelines, which are which dictate the decision making. One interesting point, perhaps, to respond to your first caller is that in cases of child pornography, and contrary to common belief, the vast majority of people who possess child pornography do not go on to commit a hands-on offense against the child. Studies that looked at pornography possessors found that less than 10% commit a hands-on sexual offense. And that's contrary to common belief or to the idea that if you're going to possess child pornography, you are eventually going to try to find a real child for a sexual offense. And so there are multiple pathways, and certainly in the legal realm, every case has to be handled based on its factors and duration, the sex offender management, and certainly the sentencing guidelines in the state.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much. I'm so sorry that we're out of time. I would have loved to hear your response, Dr. Berlin, but we are to the close of the hour. My thanks to psychiatrist Dr. Fred Berlin, Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, Dr. Chaim Malanik, clinical and forensic psychologist from Beverly Hills, talking about the latest research into our understanding of the causes of pedophilia. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We got a lot more to come in hour two.